thanks very much. I should correct, I'm afraid. The name of my car once fell off the end of that description of library. So I pulled that on the website and I wasn't able to thank you. I'm going to read for about 30 minutes, I think. I'm going to start with some poems which are comparatively new, and so some of you may have heard them before, some of which have a connection with Thorpe, and then I'm going to read some poems out of the selected poems, and then I read another newish poem at the end. This poem is called The Polio Epidemic, and it's about the big Cork polio epidemic of 1956. No honey at all in house or garden. The children were kept from the danger. The parents suddenly had more time to watch them, to keep them amused, to see they had plenty to read. The city lay empty, infected. There was no more ice cream. The baths were closed all summer. One day my father allowed me beyond the gate with a message to pass through a slit in a blank wall. I promised I would just cycle for 2 hours, not stop or talk, and I roamed the long roads, clear through city and suburbs, past new churches, past ridges of roofs, where strange children were kept indoors too. I sliced through miles of air, free as a plague angel descending on places the buses went, Commons Road, Friars Walk. I've always wanted to write a poem about the liners which used to come into Cork Harbour or anchor just outside. The strange sight of this sort of pyramid of light turning as the liner, I think we'll see one called the Mauritania, turned away for America. And this one is called, it's called Liner. I don't know if it's the little poem on subject, but it's about somebody who would have worked on a liner and is at shore, is on shore in her retirement and watches them coming in and going out. All the years she worked at sea, the liners never docked here, and back again on shore, she'd watch them anchored at large in the deep water, sipping her bolus of stilly night. The tender swayed, bumping the steel mountain, the cold steel door was clamped shut, and the ships began to turn. The yellow portholes glowed, the loaded tender stood away, the strong lights brightening curved to the prow, the masthead a star. The waltzing pyramid enclosing all she knew, close prints of cabins, listed laundry, echoes of command. It hung like a cloud of midges, like sparks, the bubbles in her glass, a living face. The wake spread broad in the moonlight, as smooth as a mended scar. This one is slightly longer. It's one of two poems about my father and his family. Well, this one is just really about him. It's called Unlocking the Killer Instinct. And it's about the idea of the joy of running, even if you're running away. Based on a photograph I saw in the Irish Times about 2 years ago now of two greyhounds falling over themselves, looking entirely ridiculous, and a hare galloping off to the left with a pleased expression on her face. I'm lacking the killer instinct. One hare absorbed, sitting still, right in the grassy middle of the track, I saw when I fled up into the hills, that time my father was dying in a hospital. I see her suddenly again, borne back by the morning paper's prize photograph, two greyhounds tumbling over, absurdly gross, while the hair shoots off to the left, her bright eye full not only of speed and fear, but surely in a moment a glad power, like my father's, running from a lorry load of soldiers in 1921, 19 years old. Never such gladness, he said, cornering in the narrow road between high hedges in summer dusk. The hare, like him, should never have been coarse, but clever, she fooled the stupid dogs, doubled back on her own scent downhill, and choose her time to spring away out of the frame, all while the pack is labouring up. The lorry was gaining, and he was clever. He saw a house and risked an open kitchen door. The soldiers found six people in a family kitchen, one drying his face, dazed looking, the towel half covering his face. The lorry went off. The people let him sleep that night. He came out into a blissful dawn. Should he have gone there? If the sheltering house had been burnt down, what good could all his bright running have done for those kind people? And I should not have run away, but I went back to the city next morning, washed in brown bog water, and I thought about the hare in her hour of ease. This one is called Dunlascarthy, which is the place that my father's family came from. And I had never been there and looked in graveyards or followed up any... There is very little information about the family. But when I got to Dunlascarthy, it turned out to be an interesting place. And the two graveyards that I looked in, which were called Kinlegross and Kinmaluda, one of them was connected with the only major battle in Munster in the 1798 Rising, commemorated by a bard called Páirc Óga Scuddy. And the other one contained a headstone which I recognised because it had been carved by Seamus Murphy, and who also carved my father's headstone. These two ones are, I think neither of them is really finished, but I'm reading them partly so that I get to hear in part what's wrong with them. So I'll apologise for using you as guinea pigs. It's called Dunlascarthy. The man driving the forklift truck said, "Keep on, right up the road, and you'll see the monument and turn to your right." But when I reached the hilltop and the cross of Kinlegross, I saw only the spruces that had grown darkening green on either side of the stone. After a mile I turned back and drove west, blinded by dancing flaws in the light as I passed under the plantain trees like dashed foam or the dashes of yellow and white on an old headstone. Yet in that darkening light I saw the place, turned left, and followed the falling road for the graveyard. I searched for my great-grandfather's name, Charles Cullinan, but I found only one headstone, 1843, one Daniel. But in Kilmaluda's I found Timothy's stone and Jeremiah's, and I found the name Bent Jones, in the hand of Seamus Murphy, who cut my father's name in 1972 in stone, and below that another name in a different hand I recognise, Ken Thompson's, who makes the figure 9 in another style, as in the stone he made for my mother and her second husband in their Offaly grave. I left the Bent Joneses in the long grass and drove back to the cross and downhill again, past the secret monument, to the place where the bard O'Scully lamented the loss of the great fight when the Crappies met the Cape Nest Legion, the date 1798, cut in brass. This one is called, Vertigo, and it's about, I started writing it, got the idea of writing it on the Great Shkelly, which explains why it's called Vertigo, and I tried to imagine a scene probably in the 19th century where there's an awful old woman who insists on going on pilgrimages and her daughters have to look after her, and this is what it's like. Shaped like a barrel with asthma, her black skirt bunched at her waist, she kneels or squats at every spot reputed to be holy. Her two daughters wait and gossip until she scrambles up and they move a few yards on. How did such smart women acquire such a mother? She insists on doing the next bit barefoot. Nobody does that anymore, Mama, but she's down one haunch on a pointed stone, handing the shoes to the younger one, hauling off the black stockings, which she adds to the black bag already encumbered with rosary beads, hangers and keys, and all the stuff she's dragged from home. She struggles ahead, joining the queue to climb the staggered steps along the cliff edge. A puffin lands beside her. She yelps in surprise. The daughters are resigned to the last sharp ascent. From below, they keep her in sight. The mainland spreads in the wide distance. The clouds are scattering, and above them stands the abbey's rocky north face on the great door. But photography barely exists. The lighthouse men have news of the Russian war. The daughters fret, watching the bumblebees trample the sea pink in the spot where last year a man fell and smashed. How will they ever get her back down to the boat? She is terrified of heights. The seagulls diving call, the foam at the foot of the cliff make her feel sick. But she does look down and at last sees what is there, a broad, slick widening, an anachronism, ambiguous, like a leaf floating where never a leaf has blown, like a word, a calc, swimming up into sight through the tides of speech, like a seal playing on the deep ocean, the gate of her days left open, her daughters like armed angels guarding each side of the path to the edge, where everything pours away. I'll read some poems from this selection. This poem is a sort of court poem, though really just imagined. In 1989 and 90, my younger sister fell ill with a brain tumor and died. And I wrote a number of poems which were partly about how people cope with things I don't want to talk about. And this one is called The Khaki Wall. We were all still living at home then, in the house with the fancy grills and the tall iron gates that let us out gliding to business and back at night for our tea. We rose one morning to find the garden drifted and crisped with stiff white feathers. They shone bluish against the red brick walls as they shifted and settled in the draft from the street. We were not shocked at all until the next day, when the aerial photographs were published, showing the house that backed against ours, but looked away across the avenue, visited the same, its roofs and courtyards blessed with angel down and cobalt shadows. The tenants have my grandfather's name. I went on my bicycle to see Father Devaney in his room in the old priest's home. We sat at the window looking towards Mount Desert, and he ate sweets and told me he remembered when that house too had been part of his parish. But he had never been told my aunt's story about all the trouble over building the party wall. This one is called, it's also about that, and it's one of the things that there's a reference to, it's about again not wanting to talk about things or everybody in the family having experienced something rather different, and therefore sometimes wishing nobody would talk about it, and sometimes a quiet agreement not to talk about it. One of the things that I don't know about my own family is what actually happened when my great-great-great-grandfather, possibly, had a paper mill out near Dripsy. He would have been, in fact, on my mother's side of the family. And I think he may have been somebody who was known as Talleyrand Sullivan. There was such a person, certainly. But the story that we heard was that they had a paper mill and that it was burnt down, possibly by the workers when he got in modern machinery. But I don't know, but the book about something that isn't mentioned, and it's called The Secret. Instead of burning the book or getting its value, they hid it and were silent, even at home. So that the history of that lost year remained for each one her own delusion. As the memory faded, they had to live. No one would buy their blood, but they sold their hair, the milk from their breasts, their signatures on slips of raveled paper, the grazing as far as the drawing room windows, and at last the fresh fine grass that had started to grow under the first arch of the bridge beside the burnt out paper mill. I'll read two poems which are both in different ways about language. The first one is called Studying the Language. On Sundays, I watch the hermits coming out of their holes into the light. Their kiss is as full as a hive. They crowd together on warm shoulders of rock where the sun has been shining. Their joints crackle. They begin to talk after a while. I listen to their accents. They are not all from this island, not all old, not even, I think, all masculine. They are so wise they do not pretend to see me. They drink from the scattered pools of melted snow. I walk right by them and drink when they have done. I can see the marks of chains around their feet. I call this my work, these decades and stations, because without these I would be a stranger here. And the second one is called Gloss, which is about three words which are quite close to each other in sound, meaning a gloss, a word translated in another word, close, the Irish word for schoolyard, also a word for a courtyard in English, and gloss, the Irish word which can mean either green or a lock, depending on whether it's an adjective or a noun. Look at the scholar. He has still not gone to bed, raking the dictionaries, darting at locked presses, hunting for keys. He sacks the books to his oxter, walks across the room, as stiff as a shelf. His knife works to make the price of his release. Two words as opposite as his and hers, which yet must be as close as the word close to its meaning in a soft courtyard, close to the spout-eaten ship, or as close as the note on the inland pipe to the same note on the fiddle, as close as the grain in the polished wood, as the finger bitten by the string, as the hairs of the bow bent by the repeated note, two words closer to the bone than the words I was so proud of, embraced and strict to describe the twining of bone and flesh. The rags of language are streaming like weather vanes, like weeds in water, they turn with the tide, as he turns back and forth the looking glass pages, the words pouring and slippery like the silk thighs of the tomcat, pouring through the slit in the fence, lightly, until he reaches a language that has no word for his, no word for hers, and is brought up sudden like a boy in a story faced with a small locked door. Who is that he can hear panting on the other side? The steam of her breath is turning the locked lock green. I'm going to read three more poems, assuming that I can find them. The first one is one of two poems that I'm going to read about nuns. Yes. This one is in memory of my aunt, Anna Cullen Ann, one of three sisters of my father who became nuns and had, on the whole, rather more interesting lives than the ones who stayed at home. It's called J'ai mal à nos dents, and it's about what happened when she had to learn French in a French convent, and at the same time as having to learn the convent rule, which was, you're not allowed to say mine about anything. You have to say our shoe, our stocking. She went to the dentist and said, I have a pain in our teeth. J'ai mal à nos dents, in memory of Anna Cullinan, Sister Mary Anthony. The Holy Father gave her leave to return to her father's house at 78 years of age. When young in the Franciscan house at Calais, she complained to the dentist, I have a pain in our teeth. Her body dissolving out of her first mother, her five sisters aching at home. Her brother listened to news five times in a morning on Radio Éireann in Cork as the Germans entered Calais. Her name lay under the surface. He could not see her working all day with the sisters, stripping the hospital, loading the sick on lorries, while Reverend Mother walked the wards and nourished them with jugs of wine to hold their strength. J'étais à moitié sous, which means I was half pissed. It was done. They lifted the old sisters onto the big cart, and the young walked out on the road to Dam, the wine still buzzing and the plains over their heads. Je mangeais des pissenlits par les racines, which is a vulgar French phrase meaning I'll be eating dandelions by the roots, i.e. I'll be dead. And the other French phrase that I won't translate when I was at some point in the moment, une malade, a soigné une malade, one sick person looking after another. Je mangeais des pissenlits par les racines. A year before she died, she lost her French accent, going home in her habit to care for her sister Nora, une malade, soignée une malade. They handed her back her body, its voices, and its death. And the second poem about a nun is a much more recent one called The Sister, which in which I managed to combine two obsessions of mine, one of which is with nuns and the other one is with trains. But getting a nun into a train in this poem was something I was glad to have done. The Sister. How on earth did she manage that journey of her own? When she was a young woman, they had plenty to keep them busy. They were small. They felt queasy. They gripped a pillar in the shade and held on. And as for leaving home, still, the trains have never changed. They thunder up the valleys, built for strapping fellows, flinging their big bundles easily onto high shelves. Real men. She turned up at the station, small, her clothes once elegant, all black. Past the train window, slid the suburb, the fast river. She saw a white-haired man, waist-deep, ducking under and rising again, a cormorant. A lump of a lad handed her bag down to her. Lopsided, she walked as far as the convent door. They greeted her with a leathery kiss. They told her where to find her bed and the hour of dinner. They knew the silent meal would be no surprise, no more than the hard bread, tougher at every slice. Nor the dead silence of night until the first train troubled the valley. She would know lying there, others were sitting up, working in pairs, to finish the stitching, tacking the last of the lace. But the cold woke her, and a subtle mist as thin as lawn hung on the grass. In the freezing dawn, she dragged a web just as fine across her skin, veiling herself for good as she slept on. And the last one I'm going to read is called Calendar Custom. It's also quite recent. What is the right name of that small red flower? It's everywhere, spilling down over the stones, each year in the sun, at just this time. The colour dims for a minute as a line of dust follows the loud white van uphill. And just now, the girls in the bar offer me a glass of water. What is that soft smell that is everywhere? The water reeking like tar. And as the cloud swells and the rain begins, the man standing in the yard all day inhales the damp safar. The red is fading again to a pinkish beige. The plants all crunch like cats while it pours down. The smell is harsher. The light warped panels do no good. The piecemeal shutters can't keep it out. Then, as his uniform dries to a full blue and half of the window brightens, the tall girl throws the door wide and the man and the air are allowed to blunder inside by pillowfuls. She tears two pages off the calendar, all colours now blatant as a mirror, drown out the little flowers, drooping in the soft breeze as their date comes around. Thank you.